University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum features Myra and David Sadker, professors of education at American University in Washington, D.C., with their presentation, Sex Bias, From Classroom to Boardroom. The Sadkers, who have said that classrooms at all levels are characterized by a general environment of inequity, and that those biases inhibit student achievement, have been involved in training for equity and effectiveness in more than 40 states. They have directed several sex equity grants, authored 6 books, and more than 75 articles which have appeared in journals such as Phi Delta Kappa, Harvard Educational Review, and Psychology Today. Their research and training includes analysis and videotaping of actual classroom situations and has been reported in hundreds of publications including Parade Magazine, USA Today, The Washington Post, and The Weekly Reader. The couple also conducts seminars for teachers to learn how to keep the classroom free from biased teaching methods. The Sadkers have appeared on The Today Show, Phil Donahue's The Human Animal, and National Public Radio's All Things Considered.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. How are you all doing? You're not sure? As Ken pointed out, we are education professors from American University in Washington, D.C. How many of you have ever heard of American University? How many of you have ever heard of Washington, D.C.? More heard of the university. How many of you would like to forget Washington, D.C.? I feel as though I ought to turn this way and pledge allegiance, but I'm going to refrain. We're pleased to be here today, and we are going to take you on a trip. And I think, as Ken so appropriately pointed out, we're going to take you through 15 years of U.S. history, the U.S. history that you've actually lived through, to show you that in many ways it's the most remarkable period in our country's history. Hard to believe. The first question we usually get, especially me, when we start a speech is, how did you get interested in sex equity? Did you get on the sex equity track in high school? Did you major in college in sex equity? Well, I married into it. I'll be honest with you. When Myra and I were in graduate school, we were both in a doctoral program, which was kind of unusual in the late 60s to have a husband and wife team in a doctoral program. That's the 1960s, not the 1860s, for those of you who have that question in your mind. And we were pleased to be in a doctoral program. And we were very active. We would write proposals, articles, etc. And every time we would co-author one of these, do you know how people would refer to them? Quiet in the audience. A hush falls over the group. People would refer to them as David's article and David's proposal. And for reasons I've never fully understood, this bothered Myra. Why the woman didn't bask in the glory of my success is beyond me, but I guess she took umbrage. And she became so upset that she wrote an article in the school paper. And the article said, was entitled, "The Only Socially Acceptable Form of Discrimination." And in this editorial, she talked about how it felt to be female and invisible in a doctoral program. And as chance would have it, one of the people who read this was an editor for Harper and Row, who said, "That's a good idea for a book. We have a book on why Johnny can't read, but we don't have anything on what happens to girls and women in school." So our last year of graduate school, our apartment looked like the paper chase. We had 2 dissertations in one corner, known as the Data Corner. We had Myra's manuscript on the book in a second corner, and we had the economy-sized cases of Pampers in a third corner. This was a real place to avoid for dinner, let me tell you. We had a rough year. The book came out. It was published. And the book was called Sexism in School and Society. This was the first book written on this topic. And we were so pleased. We discovered a great American innovation. The royalty check. Let me tell you how it works. You stay at home, and they send you money. I mean, is this a great country or not?
Louder.
So we were very pleased to get these royalty checks. They weren't as much as you might think. I mean, they never are. Vance Packard, The Hidden Persuaders. When I went to college, everybody read The Hidden Persuaders. It didn't matter what the course was. You had to read The Hidden Persuaders. He made about $10,000 a year, about 2 cents a book. Richard Nixon, I think he was making about $15,000 a year for his book, The Six Crises. Of course, that was written prematurely before his seventh and by far best crises. But at any rate, we were pleased to get anything. The second year, the royalty checks pretty much stopped. Myra said they hate the book, they're not buying it anymore. I said the post office lost the check. We called up Harper and Row, and they said Myra's right. Not only are people not buying the book, but we're getting an awful lot of returns. How many of you have read a book that you hated and then taken the trouble to wrap it up and send it back? This shows real motivation. Myra's ego was getting pretty low at this point, so he asked Harper and Row to find out why people were bulking this book back. And they looked into it, and they found out why sexism in school and society was being returned. Any ideas why in 1973 so many people were returning this book? By the way, folks, this is the audience participation segment. So I'll take the first five hands that go up. One, two. Why were they returning the book? This was a message that was distasteful. Good proposition. Any others? Aha. That is very close. About, well, a large percentage of the first-year purchasers were adult bookstores. Pornography stores. Yes, in 1973, the word sexism meant, to many, sex. And so the pornography stores were filling up their shelves, no doubt happy as could be that Harper and Row had entered the pornography market. Picture it now. I don't know what downtown Lincoln is, but do you have adult bookstores in downtown Lincoln? Yes. Well, picture the overcoat person going into the adult bookstore, taking out Sexism in School and Society. Looking up curriculum, this will be good. Reading it, getting, as you might suspect, quite frustrated. Demanding a return on the purchase, and the bookstore sending it back to Harper and Row. I tell you that story because that's where we were 15 years ago. 15 years ago, this issue of sex equity and sexism was not even a concept in most Americans' vocabulary. Today, it is an issue that affects schools and colleges and business and religion and politics and every aspect of our society. Institutions that for thousands of years served and included only half of the Earth's population have within your lifetime been open to the other half. That is a social revolution unparalleled in any 15-year history on this planet, and you are living through it. But as is often the case, when you are living in a period of great change, you don't appreciate that change. It is only later that future generations look back and say, what a time that was. To help us in appreciating the period we're in and understanding both the blatant and the subtle forms of bias, we're going to take you on a trip today through the last 15 years. And our guided tour will be led by the famous pornographic author, Myra Sadker.
Thanks, David. As David was talking about all of that, some funny images of my past flashed through my mind, and I still remember that room. Remember where David told you we were writing the dissertations in one corner and the book in another and the Pampers in another? And over Christmas break, we left to go to my home in Maine. We left everything all in these corners, just as David described, except the baby. We took her with us, put her in the car seat, went, drove up to Maine, and I still remember getting a call from my neighbor, and she said, Myra, I have terrible news for you. I said, why? What's the matter? She said, your house has been broken into. I said, oh, my God, did they take anything? My neighbor said, no, I don't think so. But they have ransacked the place. Well, you can imagine my concern. We put the baby back in the car seat, zoomed back to Amherst, Massachusetts, ran up to the walk of the house, walked to the door of the house, opened the door, and I breathed a sigh of relief because everything was exactly as I had left it. The dissertations, the book, the Pampers. You know, David is right. We really come such a long way in 15 years. I remember when I began to do the research for sexism in school and society, I went to the library, looked up the word, and there was nothing there. So the first thing I did was to go into an elementary school classroom, I still remember this, and ask the kids if they could define for me a male chauvinist. And here's what they said. A second grader said that a male chauvinist was a boy who liked to get dressed up in girls' clothes. A third grader said that a male chauvinist was a boy taxi cab driver. Do you know what that kid was getting mixed up with? Chauffeur. Sixth grader said, I don't know what a male chauvinist is. And I don't care. I'd like to say a lot has changed since then because more and more of us do care about this issue. By the way, I've changed too. I wouldn't go into a class and ask that question because I'm aware that sexism is a two-edged sword. It harms girls in our schools. It harms boys as well. Well, after checking with the kids, the next thing I did for research was to look at the textbooks. And I brought an example with me today, a little book called I'm Glad I'm a Boy, I'm Glad I'm a Girl, that I came across at the time. Have any of you seen that book? A couple of you know it. It's a little cartoon book. And on one side of the page, it tells what girls do. On the other side, it tells what boys do. According to this book, boys are doctors. What are girls? By the way, do you pick up anything besides the occupational stereotyping there? You see the size with the boy being drawn so much larger? The book went on to tell our children that boys are pilots, and what are girls? Again, do you pick up anything besides the job stereotyping? You see the underwear? A little sex object action for the younger set. Exactly. This book told our children that Boys are policemen. What are girls? Street workers? You could write a sequel. Actually, I did hear someone say the right one. Girls are... Yes, that's what it is. Girls, you have been reading this book. Girls are meter maids, and she is drawn large this time. This book said that the Lord works in mysterious ways, makes half the population that builds houses and the other half that keeps them clean. Half the population that can eat and the other half that cooks it up. This book said, boys fix things. What do girls do? Break things? Ladies and gentlemen, I wish girls broke things. That is too active. What? Cry? Cry is too active. What do girls do? Watch. Oh, in this case, watch is too active. Sleep? Sleep is probably too active, actually. This book says that girls need things fixed. The book went on to tell our children that boys invent things and girls use what boys invent. By the way, who invented the cotton gin? Eli Whitney? That's what I learned. I went to school in Maine, and they teach it in Maryland, too. But now I'm going to tell you a story that's documented in a new book called Mothers of Invention. The cotton gin was actually a joint invention. It was done by Eli Whitney. It was also done by a woman called Catherine Green, and she was the wife of the Revolutionary War general, Nathaniel Green. Now, Catherine ran a boarding house, and Eli was a boarder at the boarding house. Now, it's probably not necessary to go into intimate detail on everything that they did together. But one of the things they did was to invent the cotton gin. You know, I remember when I was growing up in New England, which is quite conservative, small town state in Maine, I had a kindergarten teacher, very good kindergarten teacher, who said to me, Myra, in this great democracy of ours, anybody can become president of the United States. Over the years, as I've grown older and watched and looked and listened, I've realized just how wise that kindergarten teacher really was. Anybody can become president of the United States, but according to this book, boys are presidents. And girls are first ladies. You know something about this book? It is so bad, it's good. You know what I mean by that? I can take it anywhere, even to the youngest children, and they'll say, that book lies. Because I was on a plane and there was a flight attendant, and he was a man. And I went to the doctor last week. She was a lady. It's the more subtle bias that we're dealing with today that is harder to confront than this blatant bias of the past. By the way, Wendy, what do you suppose the copyright date on this book is? What do you think? 50s, has that hula hoop look? 60s, that flower decade? Let's take a quick poll, see what you think. How many of you would say this book was published in the 40s? 50s? How about the 60s? 70s? You're exactly right. The copyright on this book was 1970, which means our kids grew up on it, maybe some of you, well into the decade. And this is the socialization that people grew up with. Right now, to take a look at that more subtle bias in the classroom, we have brought the famous Mr. Bias, who will take all the research on sexism in schools and squeeze them into a 10-minute demonstration of pure, unadulterated sexism. Are you ready, David, for this?
Almost. Yes. You will. That's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talk louder, David.
Getting our wires crossed here. I am going to share with you 10 years of research that we've been doing on bias in the classroom. Now, it took us hundreds and hundreds of hours of classroom observation to identify what we call micro inequities, ways that males and females from kindergarten through graduate school are treated differently in school, ways that most of you, even though you're currently involved in it and have been involved in it for years, have not picked up. To help you see this bias, I am going to need 4 volunteers. I need 2 volunteers of the male persuasion and 2 of the female persuasion. My goodness, these are people who've never served their nation's military. They're raising their hands. Would you come down? And let me do 2 males first. Okay. Yes. Sure. What? That's good. That's good. And now I need 1 more female, and I saw a female over here with her hand up. Myra, would you give me 4? Maybe I'll pull this out a little. Can you see that okay? Okay, you are... Just take that and
you
have
a
seat.
You have to read it. It's just a prop. Go ahead, David.
Would you sit over here? You are... Mike. That's real appropriate, Mike. And what are you, video?
Brad.
Have a seat, Brad. Mike, Brad.
Caroline.
And Susan. Oh, yes. Hi, Susan. This is my class. Aren't they swell? What I'm going to do is take a full day's worth of bias and put it in about 5 minutes. It's going to look a little heavy. It's going to look a bit overwhelming because I'm taking it and putting it together in a short period of time. Everything I do will be based on the research. And as we discuss afterwards, everything I do will have an impact on the education each of you has received. Are you ready? Your job, your assignment, should you choose to accept it, is to identify all the forms of bias you see. Do you ever see that cartoon in kids' books? What's wrong with this picture? You know, you have the cow hanging from the moon and all that. What's wrong with this picture? Are you ready? Oh, yeah, this is the big red one area, right? Are you ready?
Yes.
Is there ROTC on this campus? Okay, I like the way the spirit is growing. Soon we'll have the banners and we're going to be marching on downtown Lincoln. Okay, here they are. This will be a social studies class, and your job is just to do the best you can at this social studies class, okay? Mark, Brad, Suzanne, and Caroline. Okay. Good morning, class. I don't think they should use these sedating drugs on. Good morning, class.
Good morning.
Much better. Today we're going to review the chapter you all read last night in your book, The Gathering Clouds of War. about the American Revolution. Okay? So take out your homework assignment. Let me check how you've done. Is this Suzanne? Oh my. Oh, Suzanne. Would you all look at Suzanne's work? It is beautiful. You print like a typewriter. This is beautiful work. This is the kind of work I like to put up on the board for open school night. That's beautiful. Had you been born 400 years ago, you would have been a monk. That's beautiful work. This is Caroline. Okay, Caroline 13 and 14 are not correct. This is Brad. Uncross your legs and sit up straight, Brad. That's known as the ripple effect for those of you majoring. Okay, Brad, 13, 14, and 16 are not correct. Brad, do you know the dark print at the top of the paragraphs, the subparagraphs? Do you know how they give you the main idea of what's in that paragraph? When you're answering some of your questions, you're not looking at the right paragraph. And you're missing some. And there's no reason for that. You're doing more work than you have to do because you're not looking at the right paragraph. So I'm going to ask you to redo those three, and I know that you can get them all right. Okay? All right. This is Mike. Here's your homework, Mike. I'm not enjoying this. I want your homework, and I want it here on time. Now, what's your reason for not having it?
Because I'm just a lazy kind of guy.
Well, aren't you cool? A lazy kind of guy. This homework should not be that difficult. This is the same assignment you had last year at this time. See me after class. In order to get us all on the same track, let's review some of the major questions of the chapter together, okay? At the beginning of the revolution, most Americans were earning their living doing what, Brad?
Farming.
Farming is correct. Obviously a history major. They were farmers. 90-95% were farmers. How did people in Great Britain earn their income at this time? Yes, Mike, it's you.
Farming.
They farmed. How else?
Trade.
They were involved in trade. How else? Susanna?
I don't know.
Can you help her out, Brad?
The colony's taxes.
They lived off taxes. Imperialism pays. That's right. They were also involved, Mike. Good, fishing. Okay. I'll tell you, sometimes I think my history class takes on the appearance of charades or Jeopardy or something, but you got it right. Which country was earning more money, Great Britain or the colonies?
Great Britain.
Which had a bigger army?
Great Britain.
A bigger navy?
Great Britain.
A bigger air force?
There was no
air force. There was no air force, right. Trick question. But if there was an air force, who would have had it, Brad?
Great Britain.
Right, because Great Britain because Great Britain was the power of this time. It was in Great Britain that the money and the influence. And it seemed really weird when the colonies declared their independence, fought a revolution, because everybody thought that, in fact, who would be the winner of this war? Big, powerful Great Britain or poor, small, weak America?
Great Britain.
But those of you who read the Daily Nebraskan, you know that, in fact, the colonies won. Otherwise, it would be called the Daily Yorkshire or something. Okay? So, how did that happen? Brad, could you uncross your legs and sit up straight? Are we having a problem? Okay. All right. How did that happen?
Because we had strong leaders.
Who were some of our strong leaders?
Our founding fathers.
It's amazing that I don't think history does an adequate job of describing the biological birth of a nation without mothers, but somehow it happened. Who were some of the founding fathers?
Thomas Jefferson.
Good one.
James Madison.
Madison, excellent. A Federalist Papers expert, no doubt.
Benjamin Franklin.
Good old Ben Franklin, excuse me. Who else?
Luther Martin.
Luther Martin. Who's Luther Martin?
Luther Martin was the person who represented Maryland in McCulloch versus Maryland.
That Luther Martin. Oh. I thought you meant his brother, the blacksmith. Oh. Luther Martin, right? A name that will go down in history as a result of this speech.
George Washington.
We forgot George Washington. That's great. I mean, these were giants. Do you know what John F. Kennedy said of Thomas Jefferson? John F. Kennedy invited all the Nobel Prize winners in America to dinner at the White House. And there were about 60 Nobel Prize winners. And he said, never has the White House been blessed with so much genius since Jefferson dined here alone. Even bigger than Luther. Okay, so this was real leaders. Wonderful. And who else? Why else did the Americans win? They had good leaders. Who else?
Well, who other leaders?
What are the reasons that they have to win? They had great leaders.
They were mad.
They were mad. They were motivated.
Motivated.
Okay. Why else?
Oh, that's what I was going to say.
Oh, well, that's sweet. Yes, why else?
It was our manifest destiny.
Our manifest destiny. Actually, he was probably being born about this time, but I don't think... Let me give you a hint. Are you ready? Boom! 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 Boom!
It was the type of fighting we used.
What did we call it?
Then or now.
What?
Now.
Guess guerrilla warfare?
Guerrilla warfare. Hiding behind bushes and trees and rocks. I mean, it seemed very unfair to the British. Could you imagine this on Sunday afternoon TV? Sunday at the Revolution. Bryant Gumbel reporting. The Americans have won the toss. They will wear dark uniforms, hide in the woods behind rocks and trees. The British will stand on a hill in a straight line in an open field wearing red coats. The Americans will shoot. We will see who wins the gold medal. I mean, if I were the British, I'd want new rules. But those are the rules they played by. And the Americans won the revolution. and the most radical country on the face of the earth was born. A country that sparked revolutions throughout the hemisphere. The United States of America. And 200 years later, history repeated itself. A small agricultural country using guerrilla tactics with wonderful leadership took on a country with the biggest army and the biggest navy and even the biggest air force and won. About 200 years later. What war am I talking about?
Vietnam?
Vietnam. Exactly right. Only this time, America was the powerful country, and Vietnam was that agricultural guerrilla warfare country. And we lost. History repeated itself. My question to you is, what happened in 200 years of American history to take us from a revolutionary underdog to a powerful country losing? How did we forget the lessons of our own birth? And we'll come to that tomorrow. Let's give the class a round of applause. I think they were darn good. Did you all notice any bias? No? Oh, you did? What did you see? Yes. Okay, you hit two good ones. The class is segregated. How many saw the sex segregation? Myra will talk more about that. That is, you know how race segregation is outlawed? Sex segregation is the norm. And we'll talk about that. And also the evaluation. I complimented Susanna for the lovely appearance of her paper, not for the content of her ideas. I pointed out what you got wrong. But with you, what did I do?
You really criticized.
And what else?
Do better.
And I told you can do better. Good. Boys get more precise evaluation, more frequent evaluation, and more encouraging evaluation. What else did you say? Yes, ma'am. Gave him a second chance, do it over, bring it back tomorrow. Remediation. Good. What else? Yes, ma'am. What was that? What was that? Are you saying I gave more attention to the males than the females? You're correct. The males got more of my active attention. Anything else? In the back. Didn't work, did it? Boys get disciplined more frequently, more publicly, and more harshly than girls. Thank you. Thanks for... Yes. The content of the course reinforced the curriculum was masculine. Okay. Very nice. Yes, ma'am. They didn't get the best questions. Boys got more of them and better. There are lots of points, and you've done a very nice job at analyzing them. Let me thank the class for coming up, and you may keep the homework as a souvenir. Thank you. Let's give them a round of applause. They were terrific.
David, I'll finish it up in about 5 minutes. No. Okay, all right. All right, you did three classes.
We found a number of things in the study, and we're just kind of talking about how many we can share with you. Let me give you one quick example. We found the typical classroom in college or in elementary secondary school consists not of one class but of three classes. Think back. Tell me if this reflects your classroom. There's one class of one or two students who have green arms. Did he say green arms? He has this funny Eastern accent. Is that what he said, green arms? Yes, green arms. You know, students who go, me, woo. And, you know, emitting the cry of an exotic bird. And their arm is up in the air all the time. The blood drains out. Gangrene creeps up, and the arm takes on a greenish tinge. We found that one or two students get about 25% of the teacher's attention. We found that about 70% of the students are nominal. They get one teacher question a class. They're nominally there. And about one out of four students in elementary and secondary school do not interact with the teacher at all during the day. One out of four. At the college level, by the way, this silent group, and I try to make Carolyn the silent person here, increases to 45%. Could you imagine paying tuition, paying taxes, and not even utilizing the most important educational resource in your realm, the teacher? It's bizarre. How would you like us to meter tuition? Brad? Where are you, Brad? Would you stand up? Brad, we've analyzed classroom interaction here at Nebraska Wesleyan, and we've determined that you use really a lot of the most expensive resource in our budget. And I was speaking with the provost, and he and I agree. Your folks, you should kind of tell them to expect that their tuition bill will be tripled next year. Okay, Brad? Okay. You can sit down and cross your legs at that price. Now, where's Carolyn? Carolyn, would you stand up? Good news! Tell your folks they'll be getting a rebate check in the mail. If that seems funny to you, that actually is a cost education function if we did it that way. Myra will share some of the other points.
We found that from grade school through graduate school, male students get more attention. We found an interesting interaction between race and gender. We found that white males get the most attention. Who gets second most? Minority males second, third, white females at the bottom of the rung, minority females. It's the exact same parallel as the income scale later in life. We found that 50% of elementary and secondary classrooms were segregated by sex in a way that if it was done by race would be shocking. Who does that segregating? Yeah, the students do it themselves, mainly. But sometimes teachers do it. Every Friday, I used to teach high school English once, and every Friday we had a very exciting day. Do you know why? We had a spelling bee. It was fantastic. It was a great competition. It was the boys against the girls. I assure you, I never came in on Friday and said, wow, are we going to have a great spelling bee today? It's going to be the Jews against the Christians. Yay! Hey, let's do Irish against the Italians. That'll be great. Whoa! Of course not. But every Friday, I walked in for no pedagogical reason and said, we're going to have this contest, and we're pitting males against females. Well, there's a bottom line to all this subtle bias that unless we look for it, we don't even see. When boys and girls come into school, who's ahead? Girls? In what areas are girls ahead? Language arts, reading, we all know that. Did you know in the early grades they're equal to or ahead of their brothers in math and science as well? When boys and girls leave high school and go to college, who's ahead? Boys. We all know that they're ahead in math and science, but on most tests, they're ahead in verbal scores as well. There is no other group in society except girls, females, that comes into school ahead and leaves behind. That's the educational situation that we're in right now, but we can change it. There's a book called Megatrends. It's on the bestseller list a few years ago. Did any of you read it? It talked about the 10 trends changing American society. And I still carry around with me in my head the last sentence in that book, and it goes like this. In stable times, everything has a name, and everybody knows their place, and we can leverage very little. But in times of transition, we can have enormous leverage and influence if we can just get a clear sense of the road that lies ahead. As students and as educators, we're on the crossroads of that road. We have the opportunity to change things and make them more fair for ourselves, for men and women today, and for our sons and daughters as well. And that's what this issue of sex equity from the classroom to the boardroom means to us. We want to thank you very much for spending this hour with us this morning.
Today on University Forum, we've heard Myra and David Sadker, professors of education at American University in Washington, D.C. Their topic was Sex Bias from Classroom to Boardroom. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.